Hello and welcome back to another Good Trash Garbage Shoot. It's me, Dalton. Arthur and Dustin are deployed at the moment and could not be here. But fortunately, I have assembled a crack team of shooters to discuss. A cracked team, actually. Sort of goated gamers in their own rights, ready to drop mortars and do war crimes with me. That's right, we're talking about the hotly anticipated A24 blockbuster Civil War from Alex Garland. This film was announced in January 2022, immediately picked up by A24 off of the script from Garland, announced with the killer cast of Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Moura, Stephen McKinley Henderson, and Kaylee Spaney.
Is it Spaney or Spaney? I keep hearing Spaney.
Is it Spaney? I've heard both. Let's go Spaney.
I didn't want to.
And of course, Sonia Mizuno, frequent Garland collaborator, also making an appearance. Principal photography was conducted in Atlanta, March 2022. Reported production budget of about $50 million. It was shot on the prosumer DJI Ronin 4D camera, and it was had its world premiere at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and it was released this very weekend, April 11th, and is on deck to make about $25 to $26 million this weekend in North America, making it the highest opening weekend for an R-rated independent feature. They're still calling A24 an indie, technically, okay. As far as, it's not one of the big ones.
Because Passion of the Christ was technically released by an independent studio.
True. Yeah, so I saw that number,
just to be safe,
too.
It's A24's biggest, which is the...
Yeah, I saw somebody put that number on, and I was like, that's a little weird. I'll report that, but I don't know that that's 100% right either myself.
Are you saying media can't be trusted?
Well, and that's a question we'll ask ourselves this very day. On the podcast today, we have got, you've heard him before if you've listened to our May-December discussion. To my left, the frightful femme of Good Trash Media in Oklahoma City, Kirsten Thurkelson. Thanks for being here.
Hello, thank you for having me.
To my right, Nicholas Sanford. Don't call him Nicholas, he'll hate it. Nick is the director of Elusive, which you can watch on Tubi, starring Alex Sanchez and Brad Chad Porter. And he is the host of a podcast currently called Serious Storytime Talk, but maybe it'll be called something else at some point. Nick, thank you for coming and bringing your gear so we could get into the weeds on this one.
Thank you for having me.
Listener, you might notice a little ambient sound. It's a beautiful spring day. I've got all the windows open. We're recording this one like we're live in the field, You can get ready for this kind of sound when I record some
stuff.
We've
got a mass grave behind us, and someone's putting flour on it, or whatever that
There's
is.
There's an angry mob outside chanting for us to stop talking about movies. I think they have torches.
That's true. God, I can't wait. Someday, I look forward to being hunkered down in a bunker with people trying to stop me from doing the only thing I love to do. Let's talk about movies. Let's talk about Civil War. If you've listened to a Good Trash show before, you kind of know how we do things. We'll save you from spoilers for the most part. Until we get a little bit later into things, we'll just kind of start with our general impressions of the film. But what is this film about? I've already told you how it came to be, but what is this? Well, if you have had your head under a rock and have not been following the marketing, Civil War tells the story of a second American Civil War set in an indeterminate point in the early 21st century, to mid 21st century, let's say. Nick Offerman plays a third-term president who is under siege from the Western forces of Texas and California. Kirsten Dunst is not Lee Miller. That's the World War II photographer. Lee Smith.
Who is a
hard-bitten photojournalist from many a war zone and is covering the conflict along with her colleagues, Kaylee Spaney, Wagner Moura, and Stephen McKinley Henderson, other journalists in tow. It's a road movie. It's a war movie. It's an Alex Garland movie. I guess we'll start with Sanford, because I know for a fact you're the warmest. Go ahead. Lay it on me. What works? What holds it back from being a masterpiece? What's got you excited about Alex Garland Civil War?
Okay, so I'm not as in the bag for Alex Garland as many people seem to be. I've got nothing against him. I liked Ex Machina a lot. I really, really enjoyed Annihilation. I didn't bother with Men. I haven't really seen anything else of his. I know a lot of bro dude screenwriter types that are, you know, have their dicks hard for him generally because he's provocative, you know, whatever. I've never really cared one way or another. I think he looks like an incredible kisser. I'll give him that. So going into Civil War, you know, my, especially once the reaction started coming out, it felt like 2019 Joker all over again, which is, this thing's blah, blah, blah. It's this, it's that, it's whatever. And I was just like, Jesus Christ, this is going to be an experience. Sat down and watched it in an IMAX theater as God intended. Which, God, maybe the loudest movie I've ever seen in a theater in my life. And I've seen every Chris Nolan movie in theaters since Batman Begins. This was insane. I'll get to my corkboard and yarn theory about this when we go into spoilers, but just as a piece of filmmaking, it put me in what a Civil War in the United States could potentially look like. It's something that's, I think, you know, especially in the run-up to the 2024 election, has a lot of us kind of jokingly worried about, you know, what the results could be and what the public reaction could be. And so this movie, it just as a piece of filmmaking, put me in, you know, almost like it's virtual reality, just kind of, you know, made me go along with these journalists for a few days in a New England travelogue of America trying to kill itself. And there is a 30-minute stretch, you know, again, not too spoilery yet, but, you know, the Winter Wonderland to a certain character eating it, you know, it's about a 30-minute stretch where I wanted to get out of the theater because it was giving me such bad anxiety, and I couldn't take it. And so, yeah, I mean, I found it just from a visceral level, just a filmmaking level, you know, when it comes to sound mixing and the weird Apocalypse Now warping of putting pop songs with, you know, people celebrating, you know, the death of soldiers and just fucking just crazy shit. It, you know, it was pure cinema to me. And so, yeah, that's how I feel about it.
Thirk, where are you at on this one? I know you and I saw this together and we both came out compelled but mixed, I think is kind of where we landed right out of the gate.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So Annihilation is like one of my favorite movies. It's so weird. It's like it's in my top four on Letterboxd.
That's what I was about to ask.
It is one of my favorite films of all time. I highly recommend it to pretty much anyone. I think it's, well, unless you get scared easily of mutant monsters. But yeah, so I love Annihilation. I think Ex Machina is really good and really interesting. I think that Civil War succeeds in that it is a tight little film. It is extremely well made. It looks great. It sounds great. I'm glad you brought up Dunkirk. Well, you didn't directly bring up Dunkirk,
but I did think about
Dunkirk. Yeah, it's a very loud movie.
Yes.
Wildly enough, there was a baby in the theater when Dalton and I went to go see it.
The baby only got upset during quiet parts.
I know. I was so shocked every time there was any kind of like shootout, and I was just like, "Is the baby gonna cry? Is this what's gonna make it happen?" So that made me tense, also. But that's, I can't really attribute that to the film itself. But yeah, I think that it does definitely succeed in the tension building. I think that all of the set pieces are really well put together, really well executed. Maybe I was being a little bit harsh when I put together my little review, but I did call it morally bankrupt, which might have been a bit of an overstatement. But I do think that in these times, capital T, I'm sorry.
Like Travis Tritt.
I think that in these times, you do have to be a little bit careful with subtlety of your intended message, because I don't think that this is the anti-war film that perhaps Alex Garland wants it to be, was my ultimate takeaway.
And for me, I think that's sort of what holds me back on this film, which I find really compelling, really thrilling, really emotionally jarring. You know, I mean, there are parts that worked on me as far as, you know, yes, the terror and horror of war. What a emotionally hollowing, devastating, and ultimately fruitless thing for us to do to each other as human beings. There are also parts where I thought, man, it's fucking cool when guys turn on lights at the end of their guns to light up a dark hallway. I'm sorry, I don't tell you, this movie is sick. And that's kind of a problem for me. I went into this, I've been, you know, keeping my eyes on this one since it was announced. I was really excited about this, the cast, the premise, the production side of things. A24 making their first, like, proper blockbuster, as it were. There was a lot riding on this for me, and I'm walking away a little disappointed, and I do think it ultimately comes down to, for how, by his own words, Garland is a centrist in some ways. He's got a really good interview with Sean Fennessy over at The Ringer, that if you... We'll probably do our best to just go ahead and give you some Death of the Author, since there is a good interview out there for you. If you really want to know what Garland has to say about this film, you can find that info.
But it's an interesting case study in a filmmaker not understanding their movie, because I was listening to it on the way
up. I'm kind of right there with you.
I'm like, buddy, what? And not in a bad, but I don't think he made, and I wouldn't even call this an anti-war film necessarily, whether or not that's what he wanted it to be. And I do think Morally Bankrupt is kind of the point. Like, that was my takeaway anyway. Yeah. And so I think he made something he didn't quite, which... You listen to Stephen King talk about his own work all the time. You know, I mean, that's just exactly how it goes. But
so I guess I bring up him calling himself a centrist is only in so much as to say that this is definitely a film that wants you to make up your own mind as to how this all came to pass, which is going to be really frustrating for a lot of folks. I think if you can get past that, this is an enjoyable film. The problem is it's a little too enjoyable. I think this film should probably be a little bit more grisly. I heard it compared to Black Hawk Down before I went to see it, and I was kind of expecting something pretty gnarly, because that's a gnarly film. Mm-hmm. And this has got, like, one pretty graphic gunshot wound, and otherwise is fairly tame as far as a R-rated war movie goes. I've seen a lot of R-rated war films in my life, and this is, you know, could have been a PG-13 war movie if A24 had really wanted it to be. I just think about what depictions of graphic violence there really are. A lot of the gunshot wounds are not any more violent, and in fact, some cases less violent than what you'd see in a John Wick, which is a very, like, stylized and kind of flashy. And again, you know, when people get shot under, you know, pounds of tack materials, like, obviously there's not a big juicy squib. That said, I do think there are enough atrocities depicted in this film for you to understand that Garland does not think war is cool, but there is enough images of war looking very cool that I think it makes the whole endeavor struggle. If the ultimate goal of this endeavor, you know, Lee Smith says in the film, every time I went to a war zone, I thought I was sending a message back home. Don't do this. Mm-hmm. And if the ultimate goal of the film Civil War is a message to America at a, you know, these times, as Kirsten said, if the goal of this movie is to say to America during these times, please don't do this, I don't know how effective it is, because it's pretty cool when those guys in the Hawaiian shirts and flak jackets shoot up those guys from the U.S. Army. I don't know what to tell you. It's sad and scary. I don't mean the war crime they do. That's pretty chilling and works effectively. But the shootout itself is one of the best shootouts I've ever seen. Certainly in the last 10 years, probably. As far as like a non-stylized, as far as like a grounded sort of shootout that's trying to be realistic and depict guns is very loud and depict, you know, being suppressed by gunfire is very scary. It's a very well-made action film at times, and I guess we'll puzzle over that as we continue to talk.
My question,
yeah,
you're more of an action head than I am.
Sure.
Does that say more about you than it does about me? Because I'm watching that, you know, Boogaloo Boys shootout or whatever. I want to fast forward through the scene. I just want to be done and out of there. There is a little bit of a cathartic, oh, now the good guys are going up the stairs, you know, with the thing, and it visually just
it looks sick.
It does look cool. And I had the same feeling when the Western forces show up at the end, like, finally, the good guys are here. And then I proceed to watch them, you know, blow a hole into the White House and, you know, do a raid. And I'm like, oh, that, never mind. I don't like it again. You know, I mean, but you are more of an action head than
And I thought that sequence is also very thrilling for the same reason.
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
Although, put a pin in that. That's part of my corkboard and yarn thing later, but about the final sequence.
Well, and I will say to that point of like, what does that say about me? I have my overall estimation of this film has appreciated from seeing it Friday night. Mm-hmm. Just thinking about it and thinking about how many very chilling moments that there are in the film that are very effective and do effectively communicate a message of war is an ultimately fruitless and hollow endeavor that just leaves everybody involved feeling like a shell of themselves.
Yeah.
And there's enough of that in here that I'm like, okay, he kind of did the thing, but there's also enough apocalypse porn in here that I'm like, I don't know how this is entirely different from all of our 9/11 imagery in the early 2010s, I guess is maybe part of it. I don't know that the siege on DC depicted in this film does enough with the way that imagery conjures ideas of January 2021. You know, we are living in perilous times again, and it is I it's a provocative film by design, and I think Garland even says in that interview he means to be provocative but not antagonistic, I think is how the way he puts it. And I think that is, I agree.
It's an interesting phrase.
Yeah.
That's a very writer's way.
It's a very writerly way of, and the whole interview is very writerly. He is very careful with his words and doesn't want to be pinned down. Mm-hmm. And I do think, as much as I want to acknowledge the author, I think what's valuable here is, I think Garland knows that nobody wants a Twitter feed in their movie.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he means by I'm not trying to be antagonistic.
Sure,
He knows people know why things are fractured. And I think he's more concerned with how extremism begets more of the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so that ultimately the movie has kind of escalated my estimation because of that. But I do agree with you, Thurk. I don't know how successful it is at just not ultimately being cool.
It is difficult for me to watch it without thinking of all of the people also watching it who will walk away continuing to think, man, I would do so well in an apocalypse. You know?
yeah, for sure.
Not that this is an apocalypse, but there were some scenes that were very, like, you know, evocative. Being in a war-torn country looks a lot like being in an apocalypse, you know?
Sure. And I think that
who's seeing this movie outside of the A24, typically more left-leaning?
Lots of people. Kind of a big blockbuster.
Right?
Well,
you said yourself the audience you were with was mostly 65-year-olds. Is that a $25 million opening?
Yeah, like, well, I was just looking at a breakdown from Deadline about the demos, and it was like 79% of ticket buyers identified themselves as left-leaning or liberal or whatever. And like only
Deadline's getting the real
questions. That's why I'm always like sending you their link. You know, they do pretty good box office reporting, and then like 6% considered themselves hardline conservative, and then kind of the rest were, you know, sort of more in the middle.
And
type,
that does kind of make sense to me, because the real like hardline, hardcore militia dudes out there are
not watching movies anyway.
Yeah. Because they, you know, maybe kind of correctly see movies as ultimately ideologically problematic. And, you know, there's value in having that conversation. I guess I should say American studio films as ideologically problematic.
Sure.
And that's something that we could actually maybe bond with people who maybe we see differently than ourselves. And I think that's what Garland's trying to do, right? He is trying to make a movie about, like, quit thinking you're so different. Texas and California would unite to overthrow a fascist president. It's not that crazy of an idea.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that is ultimately what he's getting at. And I think there is value in this film for the conversations it will start, as far as people who might not necessarily be aligned with each other ideologically might actually have a fruitful conversation because of this film. So there is value. But I do know what you mean, Kirsten. I think there are a lot of guys in Hawaiian shirts who will watch this movie and be like, fuck yeah, that's exactly how we go down. That is exactly how we would do. Me and the boys would go hard like that. So yeah, I don't know. It's a mixed bag ultimately for me. I don't know how much value our conversation will have if we don't really get into things. So we're going to kind of mile. I'm going to give you the pin is out of the grenade, but I'm still holding it. I have not yet released
the fuck out of the room.
The lever. The pin is out. Spoilers are in the air. We'll maybe avoid sort of late in the third act spoilers, but I do want to specifically talk about specific sequences.
Yes. Duck and cover if you haven't heard, if you haven't seen this movie yet.
Prepare your if you have not seen this movie and do want to see it, we'll avoid huge spoilers for a little bit. But we are going to talk about specific things that happen within the film. I guess before we do that, I do want to ask you both, in case anybody is so spoiler-averse and desperate to see this that they...
Well, that's their fault right at this point for still listening. But
I agree, but if they want to tune out now, do you guys recommend this film? Is this a scene in theaters, at home? I have to say, Sanford, you're pretty hardcore. Like, you should go see this in a
theater. Even if you don't like... I mean, even if you don't think you're going to like it, I'm very, middle America needs to watch as much war imagery as humanly possible. Like, 20 Days in Mariupol, which is free on YouTube via PBS right now. Everyone needs to watch that if, you know, especially for people that think, you know, that jerk off the war machine. But this is, you know, obviously more sanitized because it is a Hollywood movie, but you still need to get even... if it's a fictionalized borderline fantasy version of what an American Civil War could look like, go fucking see it. It doesn't matter if you think you're going to like it or not. I think it's an important thing for people to watch, especially in the lead up to potentially electing a guy who, if ever there was a president who was going to shoot for a third term and disband the FBI, we know who it is. Just go watch the movie. So that's me.
Okay. I was going to give my own thoughts, but I'll save myself for last. Thurk, where are you at? How heartily do you recommend or not this film, I guess?
I'm kind of in the middle on whether or not you need to go out and watch this movie. If you want to watch it to participate in the discourse, who am I to stop you? You know, but if you are precious with your time, which I am not, said it before, I'll say it again. It is a well put together film. I think that there are lots of conversations to be had about it, and I think that there are lots of opinions to be formed. If you need to go see it for yourself, go fucking see it for yourself.
I guess I'm probably somewhere between the two of you. I think if you are curious about this, you should go see it big as possible. I think the movie is very well made from a technical level. It is insane that this is only a $50 million movie. There's maybe...
The effects look better than, like, the $200 million Godzilla movie. Like, I could not believe what I was
saying.
There's
one shot of some kind of sketchy helicopters that are very clearly CGI, but they're very kind of cleverly disguised with a real helicopter between them. And that's maybe the only moment that, you know, the verisimilitude, like, really shines through as far as the, computer imagery goes. It's a very impressively made film, and yeah, if you're curious about it, I would recommend you get out to it in cinemas. If you think this movie's going to stress you out too much, yeah, you don't need to see this. That's fine. If you get it, if you're already like, no, I don't think that would be good.
I would not thrive in a war. Yeah. I know this.
Yeah, no. If you're of the mind that civil conflict is ultimately a horrible thing, that great, good. If you have already seen this and are, interested, I would say, I know this is something I could maybe save for the end of the show, but I think this is a good plug to do now. If you've seen the film and are interested in more, or even if you haven't seen the film, I would recommend the podcast It Could Happen Here from Robert Evans. It started out as sort of an exploration of civil conflict abroad and how it could manifest here, and has turned into sort of a 5 days a week news show about our late stage crumblies, let's call them.
Oh no.
But yeah, It Could Happen Here. If you are interested in this topic of the topic of this film and want to be keeping abreast of what's going on in the world, I do recommend It Could Happen Here.
Did you come up with that just now? Late stage crumblies?
The crumblies is something that they talk about on It Could Happen Here.
Sorry.
Sort of
I fucking hate syntax so much.
Yeah.
Well, that makes me mad. It's so good.
The crumbly is sort of the idea that collapse doesn't happen all at once, right?
Sure. I get it. It's just fucking hilarious.
Yeah, it is very funny.
Oh, shit. So I'm about to piss my pants.
You going to be okay?
No, I'm just going to piss my pants.
Okay, that's fine. We can keep rolling right through that. Just like, you know, in a war zone, sometimes somebody's got to relieve themselves.
Podcasting is war, as we all know.
That's true. As we've gotten...
Wait, hold on. Are you guys podcasters?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, technically, yeah, yes.
I suppose so.
Well, what kind of podcasters are you?
Yeah, that's what I thought
I'm
you were.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I thought that was the bit you were doing.
I wanted to come here wearing pink sunglasses, and I could not find any in time, so.
That's too bad. Now that you kind of are aware of our recommendations, one or the way or the other, let's forget it. We can get the foreplay out of the way. Let's go. We'll dive straight into...
Balls deep.
Full spoilers. Anything you want to talk about is on the table.
Let's penetrate this bitch.
That is what they say in the movie. I believe something to that effect when they storm the MF-er. I'm really taken with several sequences in this film. If you're still listening and haven't seen the film, you're a freak and I love you for it, because you're right. Movies are not about what happens, it's about how they happen. There's a lot of really cool sequences in this film. It is ultimately a series of vignettes and episodes, as most road movies tend to be. I guess I kind of want to start by asking you guys, what are one or two vignettes that like were really effective for you, Thurk? Were any of the set pieces, or not set pieces, but the episodes,
they're
like really
pieces.
Connect with you in particular, or like really chill you?
My God, is it hard to think of anything right now except for Jesse Plemons?
Yeah,
it's hard to come up with a single other thing that happens.
Yeah.
I think he's turned into our, like, kind of the next generation's John C. Reilly, in that he can be the funniest motherfucker in a movie, but also has this unbelievable, like, wellspring of, like, dramatic stuff to bring. Because I'm watching him in this movie, the fact that I wasn't laughing at his goofy pink sunglasses is because he's just, you know, if you've seen Game Night, or even, like, in the fifth season of Breaking Bad, he's got a lot of funny moments right up until his death in that. He's, you know, my brain is sometimes wired to giggle at his very presence, but the second he starts talking or does a little eye twitch or whatever, dude, I mean, fucking, he's one of our best, maybe.
I compared him to Philip Seymour Hoffman a couple of times this weekend, as far as his range and his ability to just come in and steal your movie with one scene.
Yes.
It is probably one of the sequences of the movie.
One of the sequences of the year.
Yeah,
I think it's going to go down.
For
I mean,
sure.
I didn't bring this up. I didn't bring this up after we saw it. But I also I got some flavors of John Goodman, specifically John Goodman in 10 Cloverfield Lane,
sure.
Where it was just like
sure.
chilling.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
like. The way that he is, the line of questioning of
this is a good place for
are
us
you
to
an American,
yes,
et cetera.
Absolutely, his line of questioning. That's a great place for us to start this spoiler conversation. Again, this is sort of the sequence of the movie in the Sanford set, maybe one of the sequences of the year, but it is also one of the only overtly political moments in the film. And I think it's interesting and smart of Garland to let one of the only overtly political moments of the film be deeply rooted in sort of racist ideology, and sort of the film is frequently vague about who the journalists are embedded with, but when they are sort of taken hostage by Plemons, it's fairly unambiguous that he's U.S. Army. He's not Western Forces.
And that was going to be my question, was, is this dude U.S. Army? Was he with someone else and his brain went a little crazy? Or did he and his buddies go kill three soldiers and steal their fucking uniforms?
Well, this
and
is
now
the question
they're going
of,
around.
This is the problem with a war zone, right? I mean, there is no... Things just happen.
Sure.
As the sniper and his spotter say, someone is trying to kill us, we are trying to kill them.
Yeah.
When bullets start flying, ideology matters a lot less. This is why in Syria and other, like, civil war zones, like... You see militias who are ideologically opposed to one another collaborating for, you know, supply lines to, you know, depose the state that they're against. So, again, the Western Forces coalition is not that crazy. And again, with the Plemons character, yeah, any sort of significantly ideologically motivated person in a war zone with the means and, you know, ability to do so can carry out all kinds of atrocities. I mean, you need no look no further than our own first Civil War to look at all the, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of militias before, during, and after, and they, you know, continue to this very day. So it is sort of vague deliberately, but it's kind of the only time that it's like clearly not Western Forces gear, right? And like they're the, it is interesting that all the soldiers are not regulation, right, throughout the movie. The sniper and spotter that we meet have like have fingernail polish and, you know,
gauges,
dyed
and
hair,
gear, yeah.
And like colorful face paint that's not like tactically advantageous.
Yeah.
Plemons has the sunglasses that Kirsten said when we came out he probably took off of somebody he killed, yeah, which I think is a great read on that character.
Yes.
Really the only time, and then, you know, the Boogaloo boys we meet, who I assume are the part of the Florida Alliance, right? But we,
yeah,
never, we don't,
they're
know,
wearing Hawaiian shirts, so they, why, yeah, not?
It is very funny that to put that imagery in the Civil War movie.
Yeah.
It is, that's another choice that is like kind of undeniable.
Yeah.
But anyway, to circle back to Plemons, it is, I've talked with both of you a little bit off mic about, you know, the value of having a non-American make this, and if an American had made this, I think it would be much more preoccupied with America's original sins and sort of the things that led to our first Civil War. I think an American would be incapable of not engaging with the politics more. But I think it's smart that Garland says, the one time I'm going to deal with what's going on in America, it is going to be about the racism, because,
yeah,
that is kind of foundational to the whole fucking grift that is the history of the United States.
That scene also just rings the most true to me, as this guy is out there and he is waiting for his opportunity to,
yeah,
be the worst person in the world, because it's who he wants to be.
Yeah.
He's,
yeah,
finally able to act on.
Yeah.
And it sort of does speak to this idea of like the extremism only begetting more of the same, right? Like, once we start down this road, the cat is out of the bag on so many kinds of fucked up dude out,
yeah,
there. And that is what happens in war zones. And I think, for me, one of the sequences of the movie is, of course, the shopping sequence, because it does sort of speak to America's tendency to avoid its crimes and its wars as much as possible, because they so rarely come home to roost.
I'm glad that you're bringing up this.
It's a good sequence, yeah, right? So we get the character moment. They stop in this town where everything seems to be, life seems to be unfolding pre-war, and they just kind of stop and get out of their press van and go into a boutique and talk to the lady working the shop, and she's like, "Yeah, you know, with what we see on the news, it seems best for us to just stay out of what's going on." And they go, "Oh, well, okay." And so they Dunst tries on a dress, and it's kind of a cool moment of, you know, it's maybe a little hackneyed and on the nose for some, but I do think it's a moment of her, like, kind of reckoning with the life she could have had, that she, even without knowing where the film will go for her, I think she knows that the days of dresses are long past for her, unfortunately. Mm. And Kaylee Spaney's character getting something at the shop kind of speaks to her having a light in her that this profession has not yet snuffed out. But as they leave the town, of course, we see that there are snipers on the rooftops keeping watch over this idyllic community. So the scare quotes, idyllic. That to me is like, that's a really good one. That, again, if this film does say anything about American politics, that's sort of one of the moments that I think has something to say, right?
Yeah, I think my read on this, and kind of political or apolitical things in general, it's not so much, because, you know, I'm not a big fan of didacticism, mm-hmm, in filmmaking, because, one, it can be very annoying. It can be a little short-sighted sometimes, because it's like the author themselves not really... It can feel like the author of the work not realizing how limited of a worldview they could possibly have. Now, obviously, there's some, you know, we were talking about Spike Lee is one of the very few who's good at, you know, ending a film with a, like, 18 exclamation points yeah. that have, you know, asterisks in between all of it. Like, here you go, here you
go. The movie's over. Now here's an essay about what the movie was about.
Yeah. Yeah. Killers of the Flower Moon, I think, in its own way, kind of, you know, has an interesting little button at the end of it. Mm-hmm. But when it comes, but the phrase has something to say, because I've heard that used a lot in a negative way with this film in particular, like, mm-hmm. oh, it doesn't have anything to say. And sometimes I think that's valid. I think it's valid when the film itself doesn't, like Joker is a weird example, but I think an apt one where, you know, a lot of people came out of that saying, oh, it didn't have anything to say. And it doesn't. The screenplay isn't good enough to, I mean, it's not even that it has anything to say. It's that the story itself isn't really cohesive in any sort of way, you know, because in the Joker film, you know, Joaquin Phoenix's character has no agency. Things just kind of happen to him. There are some weird coincidences, and then there's a riot at the end, you know, and it doesn't really feel like a story. With Civil War, what makes it different to me is that I feel like Garland, I don't want to speak for him or try and psychoanalyze him outside of kissing him. That's a joke. I feel like he's got a very clear map laid out for what is going on, and whenever his characters are going to interact with those things, you know, it's, he knows that when they get to this New England town, it's going to be normal, quote yeah. unquote, but there are going to be snipers on the thing. And so a character points that out, they think about it, and then we can, as an audience, can decide what it really truly means, mm-hmm. which I don't think is as much of a cop out as a lot of people. I would rather a movie ask me a question than tell me an answer. Sure. Most of the time.
Sure.
And so, yeah, like, what does it mean? I mean, that's up for the three of us in this room to decide. That's up for, you know, yeah. whoever's walking out of the movie.
I mean, I feel like it's a comment a little bit on how every utopia is a dystopia.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, for me, it most reads as, like, just a America, huh? It's just one of
these
those,
are the,
like,
lengths we're willing to go yeah. to assure that nothing, we are able to continue our way of life.
Few things can change some pockets of America.
Yeah.
As maybe the read I got on that, yeah. And sort of what I thought that scene was going for.
Which, if you experienced COVID in Moore, Oklahoma, you know how true that is.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk next, I guess. We've kind of talked about two specific set pieces, but I want to kind of give each of us a moment to sort of highlight a sequence from the film that really worked for us, either viscerally or thematically, or both. Thurk, I'll start with you. I know now that we've kind of cleared the Plemons of the room, maybe we'll circle back to him. Is there any other sequences that, like, you're like, man, that's a moment for the... Oh, you're good. Is that, that's a moment for the movie to really shine, or that, like, really connected with you, or frustrated you?
Well, I'm gonna bring this up only because it is technically part of the thing is that it's technically part of the Plemons.
Oh, sure, that's all right. We can.
But
yeah.
We didn't talk about the bodies.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't talk about the visual of her crawling out of that pit of bodies.
That's
and
yeah.
I was just like, this is very visually striking. Yeah. This is one of the moments of the movie that really works for me.
It is horrified
because
yeah.
it takes so long for her to get out, like mm-hmm. and she
it seems like forever. It's pretty quick, but yeah.
it
seems so
it
long.
Feels
it
like
really,
a nightmare.
They dilate it really well.
I think
yeah
that, yeah, I think that was really effective,
and that you that speaks to how horrifying Plemons is in the scene, because we hadn't even mentioned that he's digging a mass grave. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what's going on. That's mm-hmm. what they have stumbled across.
It's literally a dump truck.
Yeah, it's a dump truck full of bodies being dumped in. They're
I
filling
mean, we've all been there.
Yeah, we've all filled a mass grave. Hey, if you live here. Yeah, it is so striking, and it is, like, kind of one of the few moments of heroism for many of our characters. You know, the Stephen McKinley Henderson character kills Plemons before he can kill any more of the journalists, but takes fire in the process of, you know, killing him with the press van, and, you know, he bleeds out on the drive to safety. It is interesting, right, that the character who is set up as sort of the elderly character who cannot be physically capable is the one journalist who does an act of heroism, that takes action to save a life, and of course sacrifices their own in the process. Maybe this is a good time. Well, we'll circle back to journalist talk, actually. I want to ask you, are there any sequences we haven't talked about yet that are, like, particular? I know you mentioned the Winter Wonderland sort of the Plemons sequence.
Where they're playing ship mass, basically, going from, like, vehicle to vehicle. Like, I hate when, and especially in a stressful movie, when I'm watching characters, quote-unquote, have fun because I know something very bad's about to happen. I kept thinking they were going to round a corner. You know, I kept thinking the trade-offs were going to go bad, especially when Spainy starts getting into it and she starts getting more reckless. And, I can be one of the guys.
I knew nothing was going to happen. I knew it was a fucking red herring for something far worse.
If something wasn't going to happen there, I figured Plemons was going to be next. I kept, looking at my watch thinking, like, okay, it's been 70 minutes. He's going to be, like, the end of the second act type of thing, most likely. And, that was very harrowing. I mean, the most emotionally harrowing for me is the very end, but to do that, I've got to very quickly go through my corkboard and yarn bullshit. I don't know if this is the time to do that, or if you'd rather save that for a little bit. But
yeah, let's circle,
the raid into the White House.
Yeah,
there's a lot of lead up to why.
Yeah, we'll sort of save that for the end.
For enough people to tune out by then.
No, I just want to, like, kind of save our whole discussion about the end of the movie.
Okay.
And Offerman's kind of portrayal as a president. I kind of want to, like, bookend things with that. So I'll say, I want to talk about, I guess, a choice that I think is very striking, maybe more than any individual sequence, because I've sort of talked about some of the ones I like. I do think the choice to do still frames of the photographs being taken is, like, very striking.
Sure.
It is, like, very impactful. And I think one of the moments that the movie does manage to undercut how cool combat looks on camera is when sort of these separatists fighting U.S. Army forces that they meet up with. And what a great cut, by the way, from the sort of the peace and calm of saying, okay, we're going to go check in on that fighting in the morning, to the hard cut to the fighting going on and the guy taking fire behind cover. It's just like the loudest gunfire you've ever heard. But in that scene, this guy that's caught behind, stuck behind cover, takes fire and bleeds out as his comrades are trying to administer battlefield medicine to him. And Spainy's character, Jesse, takes a snapshot of it, and it freezes on that. And that's, like, a really effective moment. And it's a moment that does manage to undercut the sort of excitement and the visceral action, and does underline, like, everybody here is still a person and is, like, cares for each other, and these deaths are real and mean something. And it's a really great moment. And again, I think the still frames we get throughout the film are very impactful, and I think used exceptionally well pretty much every time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about journalists real quick and what this film has to say about them, and maybe storytellers at large, because I think that's a big part of, you know, Garland's father was a political cartoonist, and so he grew up around journalists, and I think that definitely he situates journalists as the protagonists of this film, because he's interested in their role in depicting and reporting on conflict and maybe exacerbating conflict. And so definitely I think this film wants us to think about, of course, as all films want us to think about, you know, looking and looks, viewing, being viewed, bearing witness, this sort of thing that cinema is often about. But also I think it wants us to think about being apolitical. I think it wants us to think about sharing things without comment versus sharing things with comment. What do we feel like this has to say about storytelling, journalists, et cetera? Stanford, I will start with you. Do you have any thoughts on
this? I mean, it's all part of my corkboard thing.
It is?
What
okay.
Is,
so
what is ultimately about?
We'll close with you and maybe that'll be our segue into the end of the film.
Yeah.
Thurk, what about you? I maybe have one specific question after this, actually. But what about you as far as, like, journalists, storytelling? What do you feel about how this film tries to engage with that?
It's got some interesting things to say. I want to believe in Garland's vision that we would still take freedom of the press this seriously, as far as making sure that they are protected and can somewhat traverse fucked with.
Well, and I think that's one of the moments that, you know, Garland shows his hand as far as, like, if there are good guys and bad guys in this conflict, it is that, like, the information that journalists are being shot on site in D.C. Mm-hmm. So we know that the government forces are actively hostile towards the press at some level.
I think there's a little bit of hinting at that in the Plemons scene as well.
Sure.
Whenever he starts really antagonizing, oh, I can't think of the actor's name and I can't think of the character's
Joel,
name.
Joel, played by Wagner Moura, the journalist who's kind of hard for combat, as it were, that guy, or the dude from Hong Kong?
Joel
name.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm terrible with names in real life, and I'm terrible with names in movies. Yeah, whenever he really starts prodding him, whenever Jesse Plemons starts prodding him a little bit more about, you know, like what kind of journalist, you know, mm-hmm. like who do you write for, who do you work for, and what does he say, Reuters?
Yeah,
and I was just like, interesting choice, real news agency.
Yeah.
And then the sort of following antagonism about that being the wrong answer, yeah. and kind of just the... It's just like a, I don't know, it's like a fun little poke at how, you know, a lot of the extremist folks around in this day and age are anti-journalism because the whole, you know, just the whole fake news.
Anti-journalism that they agree with or that they disagree with.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And about how everything that they don't agree with is automatically, tilted against them, mm. right? Even if it's just as objective as humanly possible. And I think that it's also got something to say about the fact that, but I don't know how interesting the thing that it has to say is, which is that it's impossible to remain unbiased, right? Because as much as you are following these photographers into these war zones, and they are supposed to not get in the way of or impact the outcome of whatever it is that they're following, they do, mm-hmm. right?
Of course.
It's impossible to not have a viewpoint. It's impossible to neutrally interact or cease to interact with the thing that you're covering, mm. right?
Yeah.
And there's also a little bit of that, like, Nietzschean idea of if you stare long enough into the abyss stares into you. Following monsters makes you into a monster. Not that, you know, Kirsten Dunst, her character is a monster per se, but I mean, like, she's definitely,
she's had some humanity.
She's a little worse for wear,
yeah.
right?
Well, and I think it is, and we can, now that we're fully in spoilers, I guess we can say, it is sort of re-embracing her humanity and sort of forgetting about the job that ends her life.
Right.
And then sort of begins the transition for Jesse, the Kaylee Spaney character, to sort of, you know, become this hollowed out person.
Yes.
Yeah.
When one supreme falls, another will be chosen.
Yeah, of course. Classic. It do be like that. I guess the choice to be apolitical is a political choice, both in real journalism and in fictional storytelling. And I do appreciate a film saying, you don't need your Twitter feed read back to you. You don't need me to tell you that or why America is divided. And I think similarly, journalists don't need to tell you what's going on, but also I think we see a lot of fucking passive voice when it comes to the war crimes going on all over the world right now. And we can only have so much of that before. And actually, you can really only have a little of that before it becomes a big problem. I would say any of that's probably a problem. And I think that this film definitely does indict sort of that. I don't know if it's Garland's intent, but to my mind, I think the film sort of indicts that trying to be neutral a little bit. And I think Wagner Moura's character sort of choosing to no longer be neutral by the end of the film in some ways.
Yeah, he's very spiteful about that,
yeah.
about getting that quote from the president.
Yeah, so I think that kind of tells you something about, like, how viable remaining neutral really is sort of where that character ends the film.
My uncle always used to, I had an uncle who always used to say there's three sides to every story, my side, your side, and the truth.
Yeah.
And in this day of questioning what journalistic integrity even means anymore, I have come to the conclusion that a journalist's job is to provide as much facts and a modicum of context, and it's my job to disseminate where between all of, you know, these different viewpoints I'm getting, where is the actual thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the interesting dynamic between Kirsten Dunst's character, who is just like, I'm going to sit here like a robot and take pictures, and what Joel eventually becomes, who we see is a much more emotional person, I think. In the, you know, he reacts yeah. more emotionally, you know, he
sure. throughout
the victories he celebrates harder, the, you know, deaths and the, you know, losses he hit him harder, until it kind of flips a little bit and she's got, you know, just having a full on panic attack, you know, yeah. there at the end, and he's got to, you know, kind of pull her along. But yeah, I mean, I think
I want to do a Gang of Four analysis on this film now. Anyway, go on.
What is that?
Oh, it's just like one of the classic, when you have like this many people, like each mm-hmm. of them fills a certain role.
Oh yeah. 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 Well, and I think that's kind of, I mean, that's kind of why the movie works for me, is because if you had any less than the four main characters that we, you know, take this journey with, any less than that, and it would be, there would be, it wouldn't feel broad enough, but like too many, and you would start sure. to kind of lose the track of who stands for what and all
it's
that.
It's probably with a lot of war movies, right? You have a bunch of people with the same haircut standing around. It's not always possible to like make them all into full characters.
Sure, yeah.
There's too many.
Yeah. I mean, so, yeah. there are some, like, just because, say what you want about what the film ultimately ends up saying, but like Saving Private Ryan, I think, is a movie that, because Spielberg knows drama and he
yeah,
knows
for sure.
how
that's
to,
a good
you know,
example of a war movie that does it really well.
Yeah, yeah. Does that particular thing that, really, that really well. What it doesn't do as well is the weird transition from Matt Damon's face to Joe Biden's face at the end. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, when it comes to, because this is something I've thought a lot, I mean, the day after the 2016 election, I went to my manual labor job in the warehouse that was dudes who weren't legally allowed to vote because they were probably convicts of some sort, but we know who they would have voted for. And from that moment on, I was like, okay, this hand-wringing that I've been doing in the lead up to this is not working. Mm. I'm going to have to get along with these people because my paycheck depends upon it, and also because they are people. And so that's when I got into, you know, Fox News. I'm kidding. No, sorry.
And that's when he became a Tucker Carlson stan.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, Jesus fucking Christ. But it did make me start to think, like, okay, what am I, what's my American duty now to, when it comes
duty.
To, when it comes to disseminating facts? And I think it's different for each person, and each
sure,
you know
sure.
each person needs to make up their own mind about what they listen to. But at the same time, if you read an article and it's got too many adjectives, you're probably reading the wrong article. And
yeah.
you know, we know the ones, and I think a lot of, you know, left publications do that just as bad as
sure.
some on the right. Me personally, I tend to lean more left with most issues. I don't necessarily agree with the Democratic Party's organization, and so that makes me want to kick against that, you know, especially right now, makes me want to kick against that some. But and I think kind of what the movie is ultimate, and I do think it is a valid read of the film, that you cannot report on something objectively. You are a human being
yeah.
with a very limited, you know, perspective that you are at the mercy of, but that also doesn't mean that you shouldn't try and be as objective as your humanity allows you to be. And that's a very complex wishy-washy thing that,
for
I don't,
sure,
that we
for
don't
sure.
really have time to get into.
No, but I mean, it's a question people have been asking for as long as we've been reporting on stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, surely that there's no easy answer there. I'm glad we took some time to kind of parse through it because it is a big question the film asks, I think. Mm-hmm. Let's get into the final 25, 30 minutes of the film. Sanford, I'll go ahead and let you get your corkboard ready to kind of set us up
here.
This
is like rapping Eminem at karaoke. I got to really take a breath, and I promise I'm going to try and get through this as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Lose yourself in the music. Let's go.
Okay. July of 1987, Full Metal Jacket comes out. A film made by a director who has made four capital W war films. Stanley Kubrick comes out of the gate with Fear and Desire, moves on to Paths of Glory a few films later, then does...
Spartacus.
I wouldn't consider that a war film.
That's a war movie.
I mean, yeah, but like contemporary. He was a hired gun. That wasn't really, you know, wasn't really his thing. Doctor Strangelove, which kind of sort of counts, but it's mainly, you know, idiots around, you know, tables fucking it up for the rest of us. And then Full Metal Jacket. Largely his deal has been to try, since the beginning with his first feature, Fear and Desire, which I think is a very underrated film and more people should see. It's not perfect, but it's interesting as shit.
Less caveats. Let's go.
Okay. He wants to figure out why and how does war break our brains, and how does it allow, like, why do we allow war to break our brains? With Full Metal Jacket, it's not a perfect film by any stretch, and I would argue it's a barely successful film. It's obviously him, so it's interesting and nice to look at, and it does the thing that he tries to do, which is how do we detach from the emotions and the morals and actually make you feel like you are in this film experiencing it. I think he did that a lot more successfully with Eyes Wide Shut, but with Full Metal Jacket, it was his final attempt to, I'm going to put you in a war zone and try and make you think about why war breaks our brains. But it didn't entirely work. Exactly 30 years later, July of 2017, Dunkirk comes out, which I would argue does a much better job at putting you in a war zone and, you know, fuck, it's bullets are flying, you know, blah, 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 whatever. And then at the end, you get a little bit of a kid, an actual soldier who has gone through all this shit, reading a politician's version of what he just went through, putting down the newspaper and thinking, fuck, I'm going to be dead in like 18 days or whatever, you know, and then cut to credits. I think this film is trying to marry those two things, where you've got this very objective idea of being in a war zone and what Nolan was trying to do with Dunkirk, which is subjectively, there's no politics, we don't understand how we got here, you were just on this beach with these people and I hope you make it out alive. While also interrogating our relationship to media. I think one of the most interesting and pointed parts of this film is when Kirsten Dunst says, you know, I don't remember the exact line, but it's to the effect of, you know, I took pictures over there hoping that we wouldn't do this over here, and here we are. Here we are paying tickets to watch this movie. We want to see some shit. So, I think to get around what Kubrick was never able to accomplish, Garland does not put us in the point of view of soldiers. He puts us in the point of view of people that are creating media, the journalists, the photojournalists and the report. You know, there's two photojournalists and there's two reporters who, you know, are all kind of doing their own thing, but they are trying to capture media as objectively as possible. Now, for me personally, Kirsten Dunst was the character that I weirdly connected the most with because I didn't want her to come out of this broken. I wanted her to heal because, and maybe there is a meta level of, I am such a huge Kirsten Dunst fan because I've been with her since Jumanji in December of 1995, you know, and we've seen how Hollywood has treated her in the last 10 to 15 years, you know, really undervalued her. And now she's kind of building this different stage of her career and you can feel it in her performance. She feels so tired and so done with the bullshit, but she has a job to do. And of course, the second that Kaylee Spaney, you know, says like, yeah, I'll be there to capture your final moments of Jack, I was like, fuck, she's a goner. And then when we saw Kaylee Spaney actually as a 23-year-old in our modern times developing negative like a sociopath, what the fuck? I was like, she's gonna kill her. She's gonna do the Nightcrawler thing where she like pushes her out and then fucking starts taking pictures or whatever. Luckily, it didn't go that far. But so we've got these four characters that are almost... they're almost positioned in a neo-realist way where they're not going to have traditional character arcs, but they do feel like real people. So we're watching them react to these things, which is probably why the movie is alienating to people because, you know, I've heard the characters are not likable. I don't care if they're likable. They feel real to me, and much like the Dunkirk thing. But the idea is to still be objective enough. And so by channeling us through people who are trying to view this objectively, just get through it and report what they see as the truth. That is kind of the way that it sort of marries what Kubrick was trying to do with Full Metal Jacket and then blah, blah, blah. And so the way this film subverts this at the end, because, okay, it starts off with a very clear...
You got to speed it up.
Very clear movie star, or very clear, you know, movie story thing. We have one objective. We are going to get to the president and ask him a question.
Yeah.
That's the thing, you know, doesn't matter what else is going on. And so as an audience, we're like, yes, okay, I want to see them get to the president. And we have a feeling that they are going to accomplish that goal in some way. So, gets to the last 20 minutes, we have a hyper-realistic, you know, gunfight at the White House. I don't know how they did that. It felt real. It's like, oh shit, this is what this would look like.
Yeah, and I don't know. I have so many questions about the logistics of, like, shooting on that D.C. set, because there's no way they were in D.C.,
no.
Right? Yeah.
I think
such
it's
a big set,
I think
though.
It's some modeling and some composites and stuff, yeah. But it looks and feels real.
Yeah.
So now we're building up to it. We've got the eggs in the basket. We've got the chambers loaded for these characters. You know, they're in the, you know,
yeah,
fucking
gotcha.
Hammers
gotcha.
Are pulled back. So we're going to see now how they react to all of this. And then also us, we are realizing as an audience, and you can deny it if you want. If you do, you're a fucking liar. We want to see the fucking Western forces raid the White House. We want to see the president fucking shit his pants as he's getting ripped out from that goddamn desk. We want to see him plead for his life like a bitch, and then we want to see them fucking blow his fucking head off. Then it happens, and we feel icky in credits. That, to me, is why the movie is effective. That, to me, is the point of the film.
Okay. You could have done that faster. I'm not going to lie.
That's okay.
So I'm going to take some points off for that. I'm going to give you 7.5 for total execution.
Okay.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, that is to me, like, it is a movie that says, isn't it cool when the president gets executed? Yeah.
How much have we, deep down...
How many times has America done that to another country? How many times have we deposed somebody?
How much have we wanted that to happen?
We're also real weird about it when we're real weird about depictions of it happening here. Mm-hmm. Like there's
we
like
love
certain
blowing
things
up
that
DC
there's like
film.
Certain things that well, I mean, as far as like, I don't know, just there's like weird shit surrounding like specifically like the execution of the president, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's literally one of the few things that's like impacted by that's like unprotected by like free speech.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have like a, you're looking at me like I have a
No. I'm just like, yeah, you're right. I can't believe it took us this long.
It's like a little bit. It's like, I don't know. That did strike me. I was just like, oh damn, they did
it. You're not even allowed to joke about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they really did go ahead and go through and do the damn thing in a major movie. And that's undeniably wild. It is also part of what you were talking about in there, Nick, made me think about just sort of the broad appeal of this film. To correct my statement from earlier, I reread what I had read. It was the largest release, meaning like it's 3,800 screens for an independent R-rated
yes.
film.
That's, yeah, okay.
That
yeah,
was
yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
stat that I was looking at yeah. earlier. Obviously, this film needs to have broad commercial success for it to be a financial success for A24. Obviously, they wouldn't have greenlit it from Garland if they didn't think it had the potential to make a lot of money. I don't ultimately know what it says about America that this movie is probably going to continue to be successful. I think this...
We'll find out next week. We'll see
I'm
how
curious
steep
what
that
happens next
is.
Week
yeah.
ends up being like. Yeah, yeah, I think it'll be good, though. I swear to suspect it's a hold.
I don't know. As a longtime box office tracker and predictor, I'm a freak. I'm hollow. I'm empty on the inside. I mean, the reactions have obviously been insane to this, but like the reactions to Joker were insane, and it continued to, you know,
yeah,
just
exactly.
bang, bang,
that's
bang.
What I'm saying. I think
but also, that movie was coming out in the middle of fall. This is kind of, we're starting to lead into summer movie season, and I don't know if people are going to be in the mood for...
I wish this had been a 4th of July.
It would have been... Yeah, but they would have lost a lot of money.
That's
I mean,
true.
Well, and here's a question about A24, because, okay, A. Dobbs on The Big Picture used a term that I had never thought of before, which is A24 core.
Yeah, I can't believe you've never heard that before. That's insane.
And now that they're having their biggest opening weekend, they have sort of officially broken so many rules that they created a new rule. What happens with that now?
I don't think they did, though. I think they just did what they've always done. They followed the trend, and they just sort of did it in a way that they leveled up, sure, as far as, like, production scale, but I think they did it because they had something resembling a blockbuster. They had the, they actually had the perfect project for them to level up on. It's a war movie, but it's still very A24 because it's, you know, speculative historical fiction or whatever you want to call it, or I definitely wouldn't call it science fiction, but let's say speculative alternative history.
Or alternative future.
Yes, yeah, speculative alternative future. But it's big and grandiose. It's politically charged, right? It's kind of a bummer in a way that their stuff often is. But like,
oh, I walked out of the theater devastated. I mean, this was a devastating, just like brutal experience for me personally.
Interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
I just did not want to be alive anymore. Like, I was just like, please God, don't ever let this happen.
I laughed so hard when the final image was the developing photo of them posing with the president. I just was like I just couldn't stop watching the photo develop as I realized that's what was happening.
Doing the memento thing where
it's just, I don't know what that says about me that I thought that was so funny, but it really, I think, just says a lot about, again, like, we as a, you know, we're three Americans sitting here talking about this film. It is unfolded so, you know, whether, you know, even if you don't want to talk about like a head of state being deposed, right? Mm-hmm. Like, or America destabilizing a country, think about how jacked we were when SEAL Team 6 killed Osama bin Laden. Like, we love to celebrate. Think about how weird Trump was when they drone striked that Iranian general. Like, mm-hmm. We fucking love to celebrate killing somebody. And this movie just sort of says, and if your president got bad enough, you'd be jacked to kill him too.
Yeah.
And Garland has explicitly said in his interview, like, this is a fascist president, right? There's a reason they compare him to Mussolini. There's a reason they say he's used drone strikes on American citizens. There's a reason in the opening press conference that we see him rehearsing, he's using very Trumpian language, right? Like, this will be some are calling it the most incredible success in the history of military campaigns, right? Like, it's, they are not underlining it a lot, but I know I'm not crazy to say that the Offerman character is Trumpian, right?
Like, Trumpian, yeah.
Trumpian.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not like a one-to-one analog.
Trumpish.
Yeah, he's not a one-to-one analog, but the movie is definitely saying, you know which guy would do this, as you already said, Nick. So it is very interesting.
The guy that you know may have already paved the way for the guy who would do this.
Exactly, exactly. So it is, yeah, it is a, I get what you say though, or saying though, Nick. It is a very troubling last 30 minutes. It's very thrilling. It's very, again, cinematically, it has set up the conceit of these dudes are about to execute the president.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, that's going to be wild.
Like Zero Dark 30, except now it's like on our, it's in a house that I know, you know what it looks like.
Yeah. It's,
which is why I think this is such an important film for Americans to see, because this is the closest that we're, because most people aren't going to see, you know, 20 Days at Mariupol. Most people can't imagine war unless it's here, and this is the closest analog that we're likely to get until this November and it happens for real. Just kidding, it's going to be fine. But that's why it's such a bracingly devastating experience for me, and why I think, you know, more people should see it, is because this is the closest outside of the real thing that we are likely to ever experience.
It is, I guess, to talk about sort of the one thing that is on A24 about it is that it is,
we just hit 69 minutes. High five, everybody.
All right, well, let's go ahead and we'll sort of...
Nice. No, I just no, because that's, it's 69.
That's
a good, it's a,
that's
great
about
number.
How long I was wanting to go. It was just over an hour. So we'll sort of...
You wanted a 69.
I'm going to ignore that and circle this plane into the airport.
I'll crash it into a JCPenney, sorry.
Yeah, man, that JCPenney moment is... It's like... It is very funny where she's like, you should photograph the helicopter, burned a helicopter in front of the JCPenney. Yeah, obviously you should. Of course that's a good photo. Can't believe
she's it. Like, what? Huh? I should?
I should? Yes, obviously.
Are you a photographer?
Yeah, exactly. I am kind of like, speaking of Amanda Dobbins from The Ringer, I am probably more aligned with her than you ultimately on this film. Because I agree, like, it does. I don't ultimately know that it does much. Kirsten, I think you said it was Lucy on Letterboxd that Yeah, it is Lucy on Letterboxd. It has a review that's like, war's bad? Exclamation point, question mark. And I do agree that is maybe ultimately...
It's too digestible, I think.
That's sort of my problem, too. And I know I already said that early on, but I think my ultimately the thing still holding me back is I don't know that it's grisly enough. I think it's glib in the way that a lot of Alex Garland stuff kind of is, and it works better in other stuff than it does here.
May I ask just two that I don't even know if I necessarily agree with whatever, but... As far as too digestible, it's a Hollywood movie, and like
one of the questions I wanted to ask.
Yeah,
like A24 making something sort of more
like
commercially viable is interesting.
Well, I mean, and even just the way it's sort of shot and everything, it's like you can't if you were to do like the totally like neorealist, you know, documentary version of this, it would be incomprehensible. Like, I mean, you've got to storyfy it in some way.
For sure.
Now, is it grisly enough? I would argue. Sort of. I don't know. I don't know where I stand on this. But, like, okay, the airplane crash in War of the Worlds, when Tom Cruise comes out of the house and an airplane is crashing to, you know, his ex-wife's neighborhood, and there's just pieces and smoldering wreckage and everything. There's not a single body on there. But most people, when opening weekend, if you could have asked them what was the scariest image from this movie, they would say the airplane crash because it just all the carnage. There's no carnage. Sometimes I wonder in something like this, and like Dunkirk is a PG-13 film, is it more effective if you hold back in something so the audience can then project and see something worse that's there than is actually there?
No. Sometimes, you know, obviously we know that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is like a historically, like a classic example of this working really well, right? Mm-hmm. Like people think that movie's much more violent than it actually is. So I guess I can't definitively say no. Sometimes, sure. But I think of a film like Ridley Scott's Black Hawk Down, and that's a film with much clearer, like, good guys and bad guys lines being drawn. And I think that's probably still a more effective anti-war film, ultimately, in some ways.
I haven't seen it since the year it came out.
I haven't seen it in about 10 years, so I could be misremembering. But it's just so gnarly at times, and, like, it is so scary. It's, like, putting you in the POV of, like, very scared soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of, like, because of how ruthlessly efficient every operator in this film is, it sort of kind of makes the warfare just seem cool most of the time. And I know I've kind of said that a couple of different ways and times throughout this episode, but... I feel like a film like Black Hawk Down puts us in, like, that mode of the people who are powerful insofar as that they are armed combatants. The fact that they are also scared, I think, sells that a little bit better, maybe is what I would say. Any further thoughts on the question of violence or digestibility before we... Well, I guess digestibility we can kind of close on with, because I still wanted to talk about A24 making something that's controversial, which is very them, but as you said, maybe digestible, and definitely is made to appeal to a broad audience. I think we can all agree on that they want lots of people to see this. So do we have any closing thoughts on sort of how does this align in the A24 catalog as far as what they've done versus what it seems like they're going to start doing going forward? Do we have any big takeaways there?
I think you kind of turned my argument around on me, which is, where do they go from here? It's like, oh God, are they selling out? And I think absolutely not. They're not selling out. Like, this is, you know,
yeah,
combative and not give a fuck as much as, you know, Hereditary or any of them. It's just, you know,
bigger.
The entry point is easier, and it's, you know, going to be on more screens and shit. So I think they'll be okay.
Do you, Kirsten, I guess, do you ultimately feel, how big of a drawback do you feel like it being, maybe, in your thinking, too accessible? How big of a drawback do you think that is ultimately for them and what they're doing?
The emotion that this movie makes me feel the most, and I don't remember if I mentioned this on mic or off earlier, which is why I should be better about not talking about it off mic. Ambivalent, right?
Mm-hmm.
It makes me experience a lot of mixed emotions very strongly, and that to answer your specific question, though, I think that I think that it's kind of a give and take thing of where it's just like, would I like it to be, since it is a film purporting to show the atrocities of war, do I want more atrocity? And I think that the answer is yes. However, I do understand that the less digestible you make it, the fewer people will want to subject themselves to it, right? So, like, I get the idea being that you want as many people to see this as possible so that, you know, they, as many people as possible, have the, I walk out with the idea that war is bad, we do not want it. But I think that the message that war is bad, we do not want it, gets watered down by that commercialism. And so I don't know what the correct answer is for you.
And I don't think we'll find one today.
For my own taste, I do wish, though, that it was a little bit more unflinching.
That's sort of exactly what I was looking for. Is I just kind of wanted to circle around this for a little bit. If you want more on this, there's a BBC article, BBC.com article from Tom Brook. Is there any such thing as an anti-war film? There's sort of this kind of classic quote attributed to Francois Truffaut about it's impossible to make an anti-war film because war looks so damn sick, to paraphrase. But if you want to engage with that idea a little bit more, I read that article sort of in the run-up to this film coming out, just thinking about this idea a lot. So I would just direct you to that article. Is there any such thing as an anti-war film, from BBC.com? Also, further notes, I would check out this article that I found on The Atlantic. That's basically a warning to anybody who thinks that civil war is inevitable or good or any permutation of that. It's from Fintan O'Toole is the author. It's an Irish writer.
I know his dad.
Writing for The Atlantic. I'm sure you do. Beware prophecies of civil war. But again, if you know, obviously people from Ireland have thoughts and opinions on the matter. So if you want an Irish person's perspective on America's tensions, I thought it was a really good read. So there's some continued reading for you, listener. Thank you so much, Thirk and Sanford, for joining me to discuss this Bugnuts film. I think it's one I'll be thinking about for a long time, even if I don't ultimately know that it's a entirely successful anti-war film. I do think it is a gripping and compelling feature film, if nothing else. It is frustrating, but not nearly as frustrating as Men. I do think it's kind of, if we were to break up Garland's filmography into two halves of very successful to mixed success, it would be the first half of the career being the very successful and the second half of the career being to mixed success for my money. And I think that's kind of, I know you haven't seen Men either, Kirsten, but I think that's kind of where you're at as well.
I heard what people were saying and I was just like, I'll stream this at home at some point, maybe.
It's better than Last Night in Soho is my hot take, but it's, you know.
What the hell do those, what do they have in common? I haven't seen Men, so that's.
Sort of Men.
Men sort of is the answer. Men.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Funnily enough, I'm a Last Night in Soho defender. I know it's not like it's not good.
First half is so fucking good though.
It is good though. There's a lot to like. Yeah. This is a conversation for another day.
Yeah. Let's do it right now.
Do either of you have any final thoughts before I give you a chance to throw out some plugs or anything?
I think it's good that this movie has sparked conversation. I will say that is a thing that I think is really successful about it, is that people are talking about it. There's a lot of discourse on Letterboxd, a lot of people convincing other people that they need to see it. I honestly, you know what? I'm gonna redact my statement from earlier and say, you know what? Maybe you should see this just to be a part of the conversation. I think it's a worthy conversation to have.
It's very rare that these days that film is at the center of cultural discourse. I think you were doing yourself a disservice. If you like being a part of what people are talking about, you should probably go seek this one out. That's this dickhead's opinion. Sanford, any closing thoughts?
Nah.
I would say you kind of got your, seem like you got your heart's content with your corkboard corner.
Sure, yeah. That's what we're still calling it from now on.
Oh, it's Sanford's corkboard corner. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, that is really difficult to say.
Yes, it is.
That's what makes it so much fun.
Flies in the face of marketing.
He's the one that came up with it, I think, the last podcast we did.
You know what else is hard to say? Good trash genre cast.
Yes.
That's a show you can... Yeah, hey, you know what? Think sometimes it's like Cougar Town. You first idea was the best idea, and it's too late to change because it's already in the SEO feed. But that's the show you've been listening to, the Good Trash Genre Cast. If you have thoughts, you can send them to goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. And if you want to help support us financially, you can go over to patreon.com/GTM. Thank you so much for listening. Nick, would you like to plug some stuff? I know I already kind of talked about what you do, but you want to remind folks where they can find you and what you're doing?
I'm on Instagram at NickTheSanford, I think. I believe that's also my handle for Letterboxd, maybe. I don't remember.
I think so.
I also take, physical snail mail. You can send me a strongly worded letter to 1600 South Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C. And that's how you can get a hold of me.
All right. Thirk, anything to plug? Anything you got going on?
Find me at Letterboxd. I am K-R-A-N-S-T-I-N. That's Cranston.
And
I'm not really on Twitter anymore.
Good for you. I am also on Letterboxd, unsurprisingly. I am Dollywood Squares, both there and on Instagram. You're going to have to drop that A, though, if you want to find me on Letterboxd. But you can just search Dalton Stewart, too. That should pull me up. Come find us online. Thank you both so much for being here to talk Civil War.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, what a treat. What a treat this was. Arthur, good luck on the edit. I'm kidding. I know you'll send this live to tape. That's been another edition of the Good Trash Garbage Shoot, where we talk about new films out in theaters right now. Bye.